and welcome to Mangasplaining, the show where we recommend great manga to folks who haven't read much manga before. Hosted by Deb Aoki, David Brothers, Chip Starsky, and myself, Christopher Butcher, please follow along with our show notes and reading list at mangasplaining.com. This week, we are doing something a little bit different. We're doing a classic manga. We haven't done a ton of those on the podcast. We are doing A Drunken Dream. We're covering A Drunken Dream and Other Stories by Moto Hagio. And it's interesting that this is classic manga because it's also kind of not classic manga. I actually picked this one. I was thinking about it really heavily for a while, but it was when David did the retrospective episode on Tsutomu Nihei that we did at the beginning of the season, where we covered like kind of his whole oeuvre by looking at like one chapter from like the first chapter from each of his North American releases and then read like a full volume. And Chip had talked about how he likes seeing how an artist changes and progresses and grows over time, that I was like, you know, A Drunken Dream is interesting because it captures manga from throughout Moto Hagio's career, including like right up until, you know, air quotes present day when it was published in 2010, I think, or just beforehand. So that was what really made me think of like a good Mangasplaining pick that, you know, we get something different where we get to see an artist's development over time. We get someone who's considered like a masterwork sort of creator in Japan. We get to see something that is different than what we've covered so far in terms of like the age of the manga going all the way back to the 60s in some cases. Yeah, that's why I ended up with Drunken Dream and sort of brought it to the group. And before we get started, I noticed over the last couple of months, we've gotten better at saying what a manga is before we just launch into talking about it. Like, we at least read the back of the book now, and I'm very impressed with us for doing that. But this one needs, I think, a little bit more introduction. And luckily for fans who are listening to this podcast along with us and reading it, this book not only is the work itself, but the perfect introduction to the work itself, in my humble opinion, because it includes a whole essay on who the hell Moto Hagio is and why you should care. And it includes a whole interview with the mangaka, which is also crazy rare and was much, much rarer at the time. So this manga was published in 2010, but it was sort of pre-staged by a really special issue of the Comics Journal, a magazine about comics, art, things like that, that happened in 2005. And it was editor Dirk Deppe commissioned a whole issue on shoujo manga, girls manga, because basically the Comics Journal had almost completely ignored manga as an art form up to that point, and especially shoujo manga and comics by and for women. So this was their like, we're going to try and sort of not only make up for past mistakes, but do something deeper and broader and bigger than ever before. And they commissioned a bunch of stuff, including this essay called The Magnificent 49ers by Rachel Thorne. And Rachel's been a longtime translator of shoujo manga, was an editor, was a commissioning editor, worked with Viz and other publishers. And Rachel wrote this essay that was called The Magnificent 49ers. And not only was it about mangaka who were mostly, almost entirely unknown, even in the midst of the manga boom in the mid-2000s in North America, these shoujo mangaka that revolutionized girls manga, shoujo manga, late 60s, early 70s, but also introduced a concept that was a huge part of Japanese manga and Japanese publishing, the idea of these people that were all born in 1949, the year 23 group, Deb, mm-hmm. Is that accurate?
Yep.
Yeah, the year 23 group, because Japan has a different calendar.
They based the years based on the emperor, so it's Showa 23, which is the 23rd year of the Emperor Hirohito reign, and so it's like Showa 23 is equal to 1949. It's weird. So, anyway.
Yeah. Well, the Magnificent 49ers are all these people, or the year 23 group are all these people that are born in that year. Moto Hagio was not born in that year. She was born 1 year, I think, later or earlier, one of the two. But it was this idea that there were this important group of female mangaka who had changed sort of everything in shoujo manga, moved it from being a space that very few women worked in and men mostly worked in, as pioneered in sort of by people like Tezuka, and moved it into women writing about their own experiences, women writing for themselves and for, you know, younger women in their own audiences, and then pushing that genre even further forward and talking about more mature ideas, more sophisticated ideas, introducing the concept of BL, boys' love. And this essay that's in the back of the book is just killer. Rachel knocked it out of the park, changed the whole conversation, and especially in art comics, and it sort of has taken a little while to filter down to the mainstream, but changed the conversation about what is going on with manga and why it's important. And the nicest thing about A Drunken Dream is that it includes this essay. It also includes an interview with Moto Hagio, which, as I said, is a really rare thing. In 2005, to get an interview like that conducted and published in English, there just weren't a lot of mangaka giving interviews like that, especially not with the kind of access that Thorne has to people living in Kyoto, working, you know, at the women's university there.
Kyoto Seika University,
where a number of those mangaka still teach. So you get this personal back and forth style interview, when a lot of the interviews that were conducted at the time were conducted usually through company reps, and you would get like, and I'm speaking as someone who got to do one of these, but like, you send a list of questions, you get a list of answers back that may or may not address the questions you asked, and there are no follow-ups. Not happening. So this was like a revolutionary interview. This is a comics journal style interview, and that means, you know, something pretty good.
There's a certain intimacy and familiarity that you can read in that interview, because one is they both share a birthday. Both Rachel and Moto Hagio share a birthday, and they just seem to have this really nice familiarity and friendship, deep friendship. Mm. So that's what you're getting in this conversation, is this deep familiarity of each of her work and a deep respect. She's very forthright about her family in this interview. Mm. She's very forthright about her challenges in her career. It's a really deep and personal, revealing interview that, like you're saying, Chris, we don't see.
And I'm so happy that they chose to reprint it in this book, because again, that's not the kind of thing that usually happens. A lot of times manga gets printed and it's just the stories or what have you. So all of that said, that's the kind of stuff that I like in manga. I like to see the behind the scenes. I like to figure out how stuff works, how it got published, who the people were. But a lot of people just read manga to read stories. They don't need to have the interview with the creator. They don't need to read an essay on why the thing that they're reading is important. Maybe they'll like it, maybe they won't. And I wanted to get all that out of the way, because I feel like we do a pretty good job of covering that in the show notes and in social media afterwards, but like kind of not the best job of doing it while we're actually talking to one another on the podcast. Usually we're just like, what did we actually think? And that's great. I think that's maybe why you're here. So thank you for indulging me for the last, I don't know how long we've been doing this, 8 minutes. I appreciate that a great deal. Now let's actually talk about the manga itself.
Well, Dave is going to get that 8 minutes down to a tight two, just so
you know. I mean, maybe 1:45.
Yep.
Well, maybe I want to ask too, like we all,
I'll put it all in the show notes.
We all read the interview and the article, I'm assuming, yeah?
Nope. I did not, because I was behind schedule this week.
Okay.
I read it.
But I'm pretty sure I read it like the article when it was in the journal, you know, because I remember that issue, but it's been years.
I was just wondering, like, whether, you know, like, whether you read it or not, and whether it, if you had read it, it helped you appreciate the work.
I think that's a 25-minute in question.
Sorry. My bad.
No, we have to pull the rug out from them 25 minutes into the interview when they talk about the work and be like, did you even read to see what it was about that you were reading? That's the gotcha journalism that we at Manga's Planning have become famous for.
I looked at the pictures.
Just look at the pictures. Yeah. So I just went on and on, and I love doing this to you guys, especially Chip.
Wait, do we know what the book is about after all that?
Indeed.
No.
I can try to summarize it.
Yeah, Deb, if you want to, yeah, I've been talking for a while, go for it.
It's basically a series of short stories, standalone short stories that kind of give a sampling of Moto Hagio's career from her very earliest works to one of her most recent. You see her art style change, and while it isn't the work that she's most famous for, like she's famous for Heart of Thomas, which is an early, kind of like an early boys love manga, but not quite an early boys love manga. The Po Clan, which is basically about a vampire story, which basically predated Interview with a Vampire by about at least 10 years.
Nice.
In the fact, there's a young girl who was made into a vampire when she was an adolescent, but she's actually hundreds of years old. So there's a lot of similar themes. She also, there's some sci-fi story. It's kind of, I guess I'll say, A Drunken Dream and Other Stories is a lovely sampler, a poo-poo platter of Moto Hagio's career. It has sci-fi, it has shoujo manga, like josei manga, like romances. It has some kind of like more poetic stories. So you're kind of getting a little taste of her career and her style and some of her favorite themes.
If I can read the back of the book copy, just not all of it, because it's really long, but I want to read a little bit because it's so fantagraphic. It is unbelievable. Moto Hagio has been reinventing shoujo manga, Japanese comics marketed at 10 to 18-year-old girls, in brackets, since 1969. Unconstrained by boundaries of genre, she has sculpted a career characterized by intellectual curiosity, psychological authenticity, and an aesthetic sense that has often been at odds with a shoujo manga mainstream littered with Sailor Moon knockoffs and sub-Harlequin romance cliches.
Wait a minute. I have a different copy on the back of my book.
Well, yeah, well, that's just from the website.
From
the Fana website.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. But that's good. I like that. Maybe they decided that the best way to try and sell shoujo manga was to not insult shoujo manga on the back of the book. Way to go, Fana. You never disappoint.
That is so fanographic. That's amazing.
So yeah, it's a collection of short stories from, we're looking at 1971 to 2007. And I have talked at length already. So Deb, you seem the most engaged by this. What are you thinking? What did you think of A Drunken Dream? And how was it, since I know you read it back in the day, what was it like re-engaging these stories now after another 10 years of reading manga?
It was really interesting going back to this again, because at the time, this was the first Moto Hagio I could ever read in English. I had heard about all her other works, and they were just not available. So other than They Were 11, which Viz published back in the day. And I'll be honest, when I first read her work, I wasn't a big fan of her art style or her storytelling, because it was just kind of flew over my head a little bit.
What do you mean by that? Like, it just didn't register with you?
Well, it was just kind of like so cerebral.
Yeah, okay.
And it was so different than any other shoujo manga I've read. But that's also why she's great, right? Is that her stories they may look like, you know, the big sparkly eyes and the girls with the curls and stuff like that. But it's basically like a chocolate covered arsenic bomb.
Wow.
No, I mean, that's a really bad way of putting it, but it's basically it's got a sweet look, but there's something very deep and poignant and maybe disturbing sometimes.
Yeah.
Often. Mm-hmm. Yeah. David, I see you humming and nodding along with what Deb was saying there. What do you think?
Yeah, I was thinking, so for me, the book didn't really click until Hanshin Half God, like the horror story with the twins.
Okay, yeah.
Like the earlier stories were pretty good. I quite liked Autumn Journey. I thought that was really good in particular. Girl on Porch had some really funny drawings of dogs. But that was the one where I was like, I think I came into this expecting it to be like a shoujo book aimed at teen girls. And that one, I was like, who is the audience for this? Like a distraught conjoined twin. And then, you know, that has a tragic ending. And there's like all kinds of bitterness and love wrapped around it. And that was sort of how I started to figure out like Hagio and Drunken Dream more generally. And the arsenic bomb thing, totally right. Because you expect the flowers, you expect the sparkles, and you get some of that. But you also get a lot of people trying to kill themselves or being like gaslit. The Iguana Girl story was like a marvel of comedy and psychological horror, it felt like.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was like one of the most like adorable gut punches.
Yeah.
Super. That's good. A good way of putting it.
So yeah, I like this book quite a bit. It's not, the early stuff didn't really click with me. I think that I just have the English boarding school thing, I just can't get with it. Like, I just can't buy into it, I suppose.
Yeah.
But everything after that, once it got into kind of digging into deeper relationships, once it got into families and things like that, it really kind of worked.
It's funny, like, I had to borrow the book from Chris because I couldn't get a copy. And when he gave it to me, he told me a bit about the first story, Bianca. And he was just like, he's like, it's just the name Bianca, Bianca over and over again. Oh, Bianca. She is sunshine. She is the rain. Bianca.
Yeah.
Almost like a 1980s like perfume ad or something. And so when I read that, I was like, I couldn't quite get into it because I just kept picturing Chris saying Bianca over and over again.
I love it.
Sorry, I ruined that for you.
And it's probably the weakest story
I think
it's the earliest.
It's the earliest, and like the art's not there, and you know it's sweet and it's relatively well told, and it definitely kind of sets the mood for the rest of the book, mm-hmm. which you know a lot of it is just about kind of like not fitting in, mm-hmm. like yeah. into your family, into the world, and relationships. It set the tone for the rest of the book, but it definitely wasn't. It's probably the weakest of all the stories. Mm-hmm.
What did you think of it overall?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah, yeah. I got into it pretty quickly after Bianca. Like, Girl on Porch with Puppy was so strange and such an interesting diversion in art style. Mm-hmm. Like, trying a bunch of stuff. Like, it didn't all work, but it was definitely like, it was someone just really kind of enjoying coming up with these kind of different styles for the characters, and the ending was just like so abrupt and like funny in like a Twilight Zone way.
Yeah, I thought it was Twilight Zone too.
Yeah.
Never mind the dog. So good.
Yeah.
It's
the drawing of the dog kind of falling out of the
float, it's just falling good. In midair. So good.
Don't.
The characters look like, I never know how to pronounce his name, Gahan Wilson.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm.
There's a little
bit of that.
There's definitely some of that going on.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I thought they were all really, almost every story had something really kind of beautiful to it.
Mm-hmm.
Or a twist I didn't see coming.
Mm. Mm.
Which is, I think, pretty essential for like a proper kind of short story. To have something in there that's like, oh, okay.
Mm.
And sometimes it's like it's the twist and then the twist on the twist. Yeah. Yeah. They're, it was excellent.
The storytelling sorry, Chris. What did you think before we get into it?
No, I could go. This is one I have too much to say about, actually. So it's better if you get into what you want to talk about.
So Iguana Girl, storytelling wise, like the art didn't really work for me at first, but I think her storytelling is really strong.
Yeah.
Because Iguana Girl was almost a series. Some sequences were like moments in time. Each page was like a different moment in time, a flash forward. And I thought that was such a cool way to show this kid growing up. And it made the story so fast paced, despite it being kind of a meditative idea of this mother who just refuses to connect to her daughter for whatever reason.
Mm.
Like, you're just propelled along by the fact that, like, you know, you turn the page, we're on to the next scene, you know, the next humiliation, the next victory.
Yeah. Oh, she was so cute.
Like, both versions were cute, like the iguana version and the human version.
Yeah.
And then the twist, like, spoilers, I guess, but that her mother had kind of the fairy tale origin was really cool.
Yeah.
Because you don't often see, like, the post-fairy tale, like, what happens after Snow White kind of a thing.
Yeah, like even if that wasn't in the story, it would still be a really great story. Like the fact that they had that just adds another layer to it. I'm looking at it right now and just like there's like a sequence of just four panels of Iguana Girl looking over a bridge and looking in the mirror and then holding the mirror and then tossing it. And it's just really lovely. There's some really nice little storytelling beats in that. Yeah, I quite liked it.
I really think about these stories. I was thinking about them a lot. I was reading it a lot more closely than I did the first time. The first time I was reading it, I was rereading that book because I was going to meet her. And I was just like, or the second time, I guess. And I'm like, okay, I really got to read these and I'm going to meet her. I'm going to interview her. Right. And I remember reading him going, oh, Iguana Girl doesn't work. I remember actually really not liking that story. Mm. And I have no idea if that's something I said out loud or not on the internet back in 2010, probably did. But I remember not liking Iguana Girl, but liking the rest of the book a lot. And now I think really giving it a closer read and reading it in a more relaxed way this time, it not only works, but it works really well. But I think the thing that I was running up against is maybe at the core of why I picked this book. And it's like, this is from later in her career. And I think that she's, you know, I think as people get older, and I think this is a big thought, so feel free to call bullshit on it. But I think as comic artists get older, things that they get good at are things like storytelling. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, they've figured out how to tell a story and convey these ideas in really interesting and unique and appropriate ways. But we're all human and we're all breaking down every day. And so things like your ability to draw maybe is not where it was at the height of your powers, like during that insane sci-fi story with the color and the whatever, you know what I mean? And I think that's why Iguana Girl didn't work for me on first read, is I thought that some of the like art just felt boring. And on rereading this again, the last story where the author, you know, chooses to give up page layouts basically and just tell things in a very straightforward, like all the panels are the same size kind of a way, is the choice that maybe saves that story by having like this same sequence repeated over and over and over again, because the drawing in that one, especially on things like faces and things like that, just isn't as strong as it is earlier in the book. And it looks like it's one of the ones that's completed the latest.
The willow tree?
In her thing.
Yeah.
The willow tree, yeah. So I think I look at it and it's like, yeah, maybe where she's not the world's best draftsman like she was like at the height of her powers in her 40s or whatever, as a storyteller, she's just getting stronger and stronger. And the things that I reacted to 10 years ago when I read this are not the things that I reacted to 10 years later now when I'm reading it as someone who's in their mid-40s as opposed to in their early 30s. So I think that that's really interesting.
So Chris, what's your favorite story in this?
That's a tough one. I think the most visually accomplished is the sci-fi one. And the more I think about it, the more I'm just like, God, she was just at like, she's doing that 70s, like, maybe early 80s, Leiji Matsumoto, we're going to found Comiket based on like being in a sci-fi fan club, sort of a shoujo style that's like very similar in how I think of work like Keiko Takamiya, who was published by Vertical. They did Towards Terror or Tutera, and Leiji Matsumoto and a couple of other mangaka. I just love the way that the three color is used there. I love the sort of echoing through time periods, but keeping the characters consistent. But the story that I actually think is the best, and it's such a left field pick, is the girl on the porch with the dog. I think if you had just had Bianca start that book, and then you
see Bianca,
she is like the rain dancing between trees. The forest herself has captured Bianca's soul. It will never let it go, Bianca. Like, Bianca. Yeah, you had gone from that, right? So what's the one that's right after Girl on the Porch with the Dog?
It's Autumn Journey.
Autumn Journey. Yeah, if you had gone like right into that, it's a little bit more like, oh, this is what you think of when you think of the origins of shoujo and BL manga. You think of someone who watched a lot of English boarding school dramas deciding to make comics about it. And like, yeah, there are little twists here and there. But if you hadn't had the one where it's like pure Twilight Zone craziness, it's like little girl is erased from reality for being too different. That is such a perfect inclusion in an anthology so early, because it's like, oh, I have to pay attention now. Like, I can't just like think that this is going to be one thing all the way through, because that ending is not only just out of left field, it's a different planet crashing into this planet and ending the book before it goes on to the next story.
So Asterius Polyp ending is what you're talking about?
Yeah, it's the Asterius Polyp of that, except it's told in 8 pages because manga has economy.
Yeah. I have a question for you about the Matsumoto point. I love Matsumoto, Galaxy Express, Harlock, all that stuff, but I didn't get a Leiji Matsumoto feel from A Drunken Dream. And I'm curious what aspects felt like that to you.
I find a lot of poetry in his work. And I find a lot of poetry in the work of people like Keiko Takamiya, and even the Phoenix that we read, Phoenix, not Dawn, the other one that we were supposed to read, Future.
Future.
There's just like a poetry to sci-fi from that era. And that's what I feel about it, where it's just like, you know, people looking out spaceship windows is fully half of any book about space by any of those people, like thinking about the enormity of eternity sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. And I really felt that. And like, obviously it's a short story, so she's kind of got to get to the point more than having a volume length thing or a series length thing. That's what I felt. Deb, I felt like you wanted to jump in on what you felt there too.
Oh, just that, like when this was created, like, this is a kind of purely fantastical, like, fantasy-type sci-fi. Whereas, mm-hmm. I think, like, I remember when I first saw Star Wars, I was, like, really amazed by the fact that it was a sci-fi world that was dirty and worn and lived in. Same thing with Blade Runner, that it was kind of decrepit and it looked, you know, not clean and like, everything had a certain physical logic to it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this is kind of very flowy and impressionistic, and you know, the technology, you know, there's no technology really. It's just like, look, there's this giant window to see Mars, because we can.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's like, it doesn't have to have like this gritty sci-fi, like current day sci-fi, where things have to make sense or seem plausible. This is more like the space drama.
Dressed like space opera. You know?
Yeah, the thrust of the sci-fi story is about like this massive goal.
Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm.
That wasn't the story at all.
So I'm actually holding up, I'll put it in the show notes. This is 2 Tera by Keiko Takamiya, who's another creator who's often lumped into the Magnificent 49ers, who is maybe technically not one of them. And this is a spread introducing sort of like a story in the middle of the book. And it's just like these like vertical slices and like ships in space and this like kind of floaty text describing what's happening. And then you go to the next page and it's just like, even when we introduce humans and things like that, it's like this crazy grid of starships and people underneath. And it's just a different kind of storytelling. And you don't get a lot of it in contemporary sci-fi, I find. Like, it is of a place and a time, except for the people who were working in that period at the time and who are still making sort of that kind of work. But it's like, I don't know, for people that don't know what the hell I'm talking about, think of like how you felt when you saw that Daft Punk video for One More Time, where it just felt like it was a science fiction from a different place in a different time. That's Leiji Matsumoto. That's like his work. He sort of designed it. That's the kind of stuff that he does. And that's the kind of sci-fi that I felt there. And I felt like it was just like, you know, I know that Moto Hagio has like a list of works that are her masterworks and things like that. And I know that the small, small slice of work that we've got from her in English is barely representative of her catalog, let alone the completion of her work. But when I read that, I was just like, oh, there's got to be masterworks that are like this that she's done. There's got to be some epic sci-fi story that she's done that's everyone's floating beautifully in space doing.
Isn't it marginal?
Like big things. I feel like, sorry, go ahead.
There's a couple of books that Rachel mentions in the foreword. Like one's called Marginal, which is like it's supposed to be kind of like this masterpiece sci-fi story, like her at her mature ability sci-fi story. Then there's Otherworld Barbara, which Fantagraphics has put up in 2 volumes, which is a real, that one, I think if you like her sci-fi stuff that you see here, you'll really enjoy Otherworld Barbara. But it's a really head spinning kind of like Mobius style intense sci-fi story.
Yeah. Nice. I like it.
It's really good. I mean, it's like, it's not a light read. Like it took me like a couple days to go through it, and I can whip through a manga in like an hour. Max.
Usually. The manga bursts into flames when she's done.
That's so painful for me as a comic artist.
Sorry. I think Raina Telgemeier said something like that, right? People go like, oh, I read your book in 1 hour. And she's like, oh, it took me a year to draw.
Yeah. My takeaway from A Drunken Dream was this would be an image series that took place over 50 issues.
Yes.
Like the fact that it was like this short story that just kind of was basically about like space and love over time and death, and it felt like this massive epic that was in a short story. And I'm like, oh yeah, if this was done in Image, it would take someone like 50 issues to tell this story.
So are you saying that John Byrne was right about decompression? Because that's what I'm hearing.
John Byrne's got some solid ideas about a lot of things.
Though, speaking of cranky comics people, it's funny. I also felt like Keiko Takamiya was a touch point for the sci-fi action in here, which is funny because Moto Hagio and Takamiya don't get along. It's kind of like an Aretha Franklin, Patti LaBelle situation.
It kind of is.
I don't know enough to summarize, but check the show notes. I'm sure Chris will have something good we'll for you in there.
Yeah, Chris, dig into this.
You know what? If we can get Rachel on a manga spinning list to me, that would be really interesting. Because apparently Moto Hagio just wrote a biography where Rachel was basically like, oh, she's finally telling the story. She finally, you know, well, she didn't say it this way, but my interpretation is she has zero fucks to give anymore. So yeah. she's just saying it. But apparently there's some bad blood between them. But they were roommates. And I guess, you know, like, don't know, the friends, rivals. I remember in my interview with her, I asked her about it, and she was very frank but diplomatic about it.
Yeah. There were like plagiarism accusations. It was a whole thing.
Wow.
So there'll be some really fun show notes this time. But I've got a question for the manga experts here with today.
All right, lay it on me.
Page 111. Does that look like a drawing from Paradise Kiss to you?
There are no page numbers on this damn thing.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, wait, no. Right
corner. It's in the inside. Ah.
Yeah.
Can one of you hold it up for me so I can see?
I'm going to try and find it.
We all will.
Oh, that one.
Wow. Mm. Yep.
Yeah. Because something I was thinking about throughout this book, I mentioned like not knowing who the heck this was for, because some stories seemed really sophisticated for a shoujo audience. Not that shoujo audiences are unsophisticated, but like there's a step above, like Jose, you know?
I think they are.
Some felt more
stories.
Like Jose. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this drawing, I was like, oh, first of all, I mean, this is from like more or less now. But it felt so modern and like something that someone would have seen when they were a kid and kind of like filtered through their influences.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. I think there's stuff. I think that's the thing. When we talk about people like this, we're talking about foundational manga creators. It's one of the ideas that has most stuck with me that we talked about on the Tezuka episode. And it was Tezuka grew up making manga and never having gotten to read Tezuka. He got to read other people.
Yeah.
He got to sort of pull in things from novelists and things like that, but there was no literary canon of manga that existed sort of before he started making his manga. So he's just going out there and stumbling through stuff. I think, you know, someone like Aizawa, she has clearly read the hits. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he's a shoujo mangaka that has like developed such a unique personal style that's based on like generations of like reading of manga that's based on manga that's based on manga. And you see a lot of that now in manga as well. And I think it's always cited as a bad thing. Like, oh, it's a photocopy of a photocopy, but it's like, no, sometimes it brings out really interesting things. That's how you get the sort of like gnarly bits of people's styles. You know what I mean? Like, if you're not ever bringing in any other outside influences, yeah, it can kind of get up its own ass a little bit. But like, yeah, I think that manga that have like ingested all of this manga that's come before them and then turned out something afterwards usually can yield some pretty awesome results. Like, I think Aizawa draws like Aizawa and maybe no one else, but it's kind of awesome to see an illustration like that that clearly looks like it could have been done by Aizawa at some
like
point
in the
too.
Ballpark in the conversation. I should say
that particular story, Haunch and Half God, I may like it the most in the book, but the art is the worst.
Ooh, tell me more.
That's fair.
I mean, there's just a lot of kind of bad drawings in it and weird choices.
It's much less elegant than the other ones, too. There's a lot less, like, flagrant isn't a word.
Yeah. Like on 107... the storytelling is fine, but almost every panel has bad drawing elements to it. I'll hold it up for Chris.
Oh.
Like that
one?
The hallway scene is just so poorly drawn with like weird effects added to it that don't help it at all. The drawing of the doctor at the bottom is like bad. The drawing of the door is bad. Like, done with like a weird, thick, chunky line. And there's so much in that story that just like kind of puts me off visually. But the story itself feels very complex about like your relationship to family and beauty and sacrifice and ignorance, and like there's a lot going on in that story, probably more than any of the stories.
And Drunken Dream Hanshin, and I think the one before Drunken Dream,
Autumn Journey.
There's Autumn Journey. Yeah.
Autumn Journey. Oh, no, Marie 10 years later. Yeah.
Yeah.
That one. Like, they were all drawn in the same year. And I would like to know the order, like, when they came out. I mean, I could Google it after the podcast is done. But, like, they're so different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-mm.
So, it looks like it's A Drunken Dream was drawn for an art book in 1980, and then Hanshin and Angel Mimic were drawn in 84. And then Marie 10 years later was drawn in, it says 77 on Wikipedia, but
wow.
I don't know if I don't know what it says in the book. We'll figure it out. Maybe this is the
kind they're of all 385 in the books. Yeah. There might be publication dates or maybe Tacoban dates.
Yeah, it might be in the date when it was collected in a collection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's some bad drawings in Marie 10 years later, for sure. That was the weirdest story.
Mm-hmm. About the depressed girl?
I thought I would like it more than I did by the end of it, if that makes sense.
I liked it. It's funny because by the end of it, I liked it a lot. Mm. But throughout, I'm just like, oh, where are they going with this? But then I kind of realized towards the end, it was really summing up a feeling that I've been kind of having a little bit of lately, which is looking back on your weird friendships in the 20s where everything seemed limitless and possible. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that final page is just such an interesting stylistic choice. And it feels like the memory of friendship of a time. That mm-hmm. that kind of hazy line of work, the radiating out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a lot of amazing memories of being in my 20s in Toronto with my group of friends, where you're all each paying $200 for a room in a giant house, and just wasting our days away, but not really. There's so much potential and possibility there, and fun and laughter and then you get older and everything dissolves and crushes down on you and
life happens.
It really summed up the feeling of it, I thought. Mm-hmm. So I kind of came around on it by the end.
Yeah, these are definitely you can definitely see the evolution of how she thinks about human relationships.
Yeah.
Mm.
As she grows up. The first two stories are kind of wouldn't it be interesting and melodramatic if this happened? And, the girl with the puppy is kind of it's kind of like a little middle finger to people's conformity.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you get into the stuff and then the drunken dream story is kind of sci-fi, what of this thing about reincarnation and, making, love that is doomed and things like that. Whereas when you get into Iguana Girl and Hanshin, that's when she starts to really dive into, I guess it feels like more complex or I guess uncomfortable.
Melancholy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Feelings about relationships, right? Where it's more, it's not like there are any enemies or anyone evil, and it's not like there's any easy answers, but it's like, one thing that really struck me in my conversation with her, and this is in the interview as well, was that her parents were not supportive of her her drawing comics. Like they were, they were actively dismissive of it, to the point that even when she won this award from the Emperor, the first female cartoonist to get this, it's like a knighthood. Frankly, it's a huge, huge honor. Her parents, she told me, were still like, "That's nice." What?
it's not like you got it for being a doctor.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But the way that she described it, and I read that in Iguana Girl, right? Where it's a sense of, and in her interview, she kind of says this too. It's like, I just came to the realization that it wasn't that I was, and I'm paraphrasing, but not that I was necessarily a bad person or not worthy of love, but that my mother just wasn't capable of loving me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. You made me look up Wikipedia here, Deb, and the stories that you cite as being sort of more mature and digging in, those are ones where she was working for a pretty standard, she was working for Besatsu Shoujo and then Shoujo Friend for some of the early stuff. The Girl on the Porch with Puppy, with the Twilight Zone one, was actually in Calm.
Sci-fi
Gekiga magazine, which is interesting. But she starts working on Hanshin and Angel Mimic and Iguana Girl. She starts working on Petite Flower, which was an older aimed shoujo manga, maybe before there was really Jose magazines and things like that. So it's interesting to see that she moves, those are more mature stories that were in a more mature magazine. And even A Drunken Dream was actually a completely standalone story, which is why it's in color. It was drawn for one of her art books from the 1980s. So it's interesting to see not only how her work changes over time, but I think it's interesting that it changes depending on what venue it was in what she could maybe get away with. Mm-hmm. We think about manga as having this kind of unlimited freedom, but it's really, really defined by what magazine you're in a lot of ways, where not everything she's doing here, Marie Maurier 10 years later was actually in Big Comics Original, which is like a seinen manga magazine for like for dudes, and that's like, oh, okay, it's from a dude's point of view.
Yeah,
it's about romance lost. It's like a sad story. Yeah. So all of a sudden, like, it changes again. It's fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm. So can you tell me about Tezuka's Calm magazine? You said that Girl on Porch with Puppy ran in.
Yeah, so that was actually the one that serialized Phoenix.
Okay.
It came up when we covered Phoenix. He actually launched that magazine to launch the like version of Phoenix that became the version of Phoenix that we got before. He had run some like short stories that he didn't quite capture what he wanted to with the Phoenix story. So he launched that as a rival to the big Gekiga magazine at the time, which was Garo magazine. And he's like, oh, why are these people getting, like, I'm outselling them 10-1, but why are they getting all this press and all this buzz? Tezuka was notoriously really a jealous dude.
Yeah.
So he's like, I'll show them. I'll launch my own Gekiga magazine.
My own art comics. I can do art comics too.
And it's why I think he didn't know what he was doing entirely. And that's why Phoenix 1 has all these weird shifts in tone that, like, Chip was talking about. It's like, oh, they go from like murdering and eating the babies to like a funny fisticuffs thing, like with like dancing horses. And like, he had never done a book for adults before. I think by the time you get around to Future, it's a lot more consistent. And then later volumes are even more consistent.
Yeah.
But Calm Magazine had just like an all-star cast, and so little of it's been translated. But I know, so we all visited the Shotaro Ishinomori Museum when we were in Japan. Shotaro Ishinomori created sort of a bunch of classic important manga characters, including like Kamen Rider and like Power Rangers, among other things. So his big story that was ran in Calm was called June, and it's the one about the boy who is drawing, and it becomes this like almost phantasmagorical thing about this boy who's drawing. There's like a statue, I don't know if you saw it, but where he was like drawing, and he was drawing like Ishinomori at the Ishinomori Museum. Mm-hmm. But it's like, it's basically just, he wants to tell these silent stories. And that's the kind of magazine that Calm was. Like, he's like, anything goes as long as it's like for grownups and like pushing at the boundaries of manga expression and Gekiga and realism. And so it's a bunch of people that have been doing commercial comics for a really long time, you know, trying their hand at that, versus Garo, which was, other than especially maybe 10 years in, and I'm not the world's foremost expert on Garo, I think it's Ryan Holmberg, at least in English, but at least 10 years in, it's people who had never made comics, who were making comics in doujinshi and like things for themselves, who had read all this stuff and been like, no, I want to tell this other story. And so there's just like a rawness to the work in Garo a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And even Garo, it feels like it started from a place of being really dissatisfied with mainstream comics. Like it's like started as a response, which is, you know, when you're running, oh, what's the big Garo title that launched?
Kamui.
Thanks. Legend of Kamui, where it's just like, we're going to tell this classic, you know, Japanese tale, but it's really going to be about the student movement and protesting against unfair government stuff in the middle of, like, you know, the riots and things like that. And it became this like flashpoint. So does that answer? That's a lot. Yeah,
no, that makes perfect sense. Not a short answer. Because basically I wanted to know the context around it, because I realized Girl on Porch with Puppy, more than anything, reminds me, like, this could be a Richard Corbin story from the 70s.
Mm. Absolutely.
It would be drawn completely differently, of course, but the kind of like, you're in this setting, like, kind of, you don't know what's going on, and there's a twist ending, and it's about society in the end. Like, that's mm-hmm. such a 70s underground thing to me.
But it feels like, knowing now that it was in like this kind of sci-fi-ish magazine, it feels like she had this story and then was like, oh, I guess the last page, it's sci-fi.
It's a little bit of a shame that they didn't
twist, explain it's sci-fi.
Explain that context in this book.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it just, it gives you a copyright and a year, but it doesn't explain, you know, the context that we're talking about now.
Mm-hmm. That's what the fan press is for. I mean, that's why we're here, right?
I guess so.
Yeah, it really is. And this is such like a cool trip down, not memory lane, like manga history, because of that, because there are so many different magazines and styles and eras represented in like across 10 stories.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I asked Chris what his favorite was. Deb, what was your favorite story in this?
I kind of have a weakness for Iguana Girl, just because it kind of like pulls into this. It tells this interesting story from different points of view. Like for a good deal of the story, you think she really is a girl with an iguana head. And then there's a point where it says, here's what her sister sees. And here's what her classmates see. And that her body
dysmorphia.
Is just in her imagination. But it's such a powerful metaphor for a girl dealing with growing up and being told that she's less than all her life and still finding happiness somehow.
Yeah.
You know, like this, it's still kind of sad and surreal, but at the main theme at the end is this sense of, I'm at peace with this.
Yeah. I found I could really relate to it, especially the scene where her mother is angry at her for getting 97% on the test instead of 100.
Same.
Except my mom was upset that I got 59% instead of 100. But other than that, it's very similar.
But it still stings. Remember it like yesterday.
Yeah. Chris mentioned that being a very like mundane looking story, storytelling wise. And I agree, but I think that's part of the storytelling, I guess, the mundanity of it.
I should be clear. Yeah. I liked it a lot more this read through. I actually really like that story.
There's so many cute drawings of her.
Yeah.
It's almost like she just did a normal slice of life story, but there's a lizard girl in it, you know?
It's really accomplished. I think it's the one story that hits it out of the park on the writing and the art.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say I disagreed, Chip, with something you said earlier. I don't think it would have worked without the framing sequence. I think the framing sequence is the second twist that really makes it work. Because without the framing sequence, she just has sort of body dysmorphia and she learns to overcome it and be happy, right? But no. with the actual framing sequence, she really, like, they're like, it's in within the context of the story, her mother really was cursed. Mm. Her mother really was an iguana that was like maintaining human form through whatever. And it's that changes that from, yeah, you've got to put up with shit and, you know, the things that you carry with you can affect how you view yourself, to people really are different and that's actually okay. It doesn't, like, this is a curse, but it's become your life and it doesn't have to be a curse. It's about what you do with that and how you move forward in the world. And I think it becomes a more complicated message that is better in my feelings, because it's got this framing sequence that says, no, she really is at least part like magic iguana in the story, which doesn't, like, I'm saying this, it doesn't play on the story at all. But like what it says about the character and what it says about her gives you a much richer message. And I'm not one that needs messages in their comics, but like, I am so happy that I caught it this time around because I didn't the first time. And I think I didn't appreciate the story because of it.
I suppose. I mean, I like the twist and I think it added, but also ending it on her seeing her mother's dead body and pulling the sheet and seeing that she's an iguana. Like that's a great twist. That's what's created this, this feeling in her. Like, I don't know. I see that as a hopeful ending as well, but like, the fact that like she sees that her mother actually kind of suffered from this and was inflicting it upon her all this time. And also by that point, the character is already like better.
Yeah. She's adjusted. Yeah. Well adjusted.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because some people are iguanas and some people are bulls and some people are birds and some people are just people and it's not a big deal. And I think I liked that part of it.
Follow up question, Chris, what animal am I?
You are Chip Zdarsky.
Wow.
I like it.
Hmm.
I am something of an
now
animal.
Now he wants to change his answer.
I did think that the bull boy was cute.
Oh, of course.
I mean, we all saw that coming.
Yeah.
And also the fellow from Autumn Journey.
Yeah, that's not a twist.
Yeah, no wonder you can't get over your dead girlfriend. It's because you're secretly gay.
I do have one last point on Iguana Girl. Like, I like hearing what all of you took from it because I think we all got a different positive message from it. Because for me, it was about like kind of the way we pass down things to our kids, our own trauma, our own issues. Because the mother was afraid of being ugly. And when her daughter was born and looks like an iguana, she's like, oh no, like this is my nightmare. And she can't take it like at all. And so the daughter kind of is forced to find her own way, like through baseball, through friends, all this kind of thing. And in the end, it's basically like a journal of my iguana mother, where she comes to peace with what
happened. Journal of my
That's
iguana
so true.
Mother. That's amazing. Oh, no. Yeah, no, yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
There's such a beautiful panel of her holding her child just really tenderly.
Yeah.
That's just like, it's just so beautiful.
And when she freaks out when she sees her mother's face, like that's such a good moment too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great story.
Mm-hmm.
David, what is your favorite story?
I think Iguana Girl.
Yeah.
I think that's the one where like, as I was reading it, I was like, oh, this is the one. Like, this is clicking now. You know, the early stuff, like the English boarding school, like, you know, Johan, whatever, it's fine. But this kind of like deep emotional family stuff in a vaguely modern setting worked for me.
We haven't really talked about Angel Mimic.
Oh, yeah. That one's, I think, very short, very traditional Josei manga.
Yeah.
Like, you know, this romance between a teacher and a student. But the little, the reveal at the end is like, oh, that's why she tried to commit suicide, you know? That's why she's so troubled.
Yeah.
I think I would have liked it better as a novel or something. Because as I was reading it, I was like, oh, this is just a really tedious, illegal romance. I was like, this is really the shoujo manga one. This is a fantasy. And then it was very much not a fantasy by the end. Yeah. Like, it was touching, but it didn't really land with me the way Iguana Girl or Hanshin did.
Yeah, I agree. Mm. I liked how by the end of that story, she just kind of like looked like an old lady, like the way she was like draped in the shawl and stuff. Mm-hmm. There's something about her style as it progressed through the story that I don't know if that was conscious or not to make her just seem older and older by the end.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was interesting. You're saying about Willow Tree?
The Willow Tree, I really enjoyed reading because it reminded me of one of my favorite Usagi Yojimbo stories, which I think is just called Jizo.
Oh, yeah? And but the Jizo statues.
Yeah, where it's the same kind of force, like the same perspective, several panels, and it's basically a statue like watching like bandits come by and like ravishing an area, then Usagi killing the bandits, and like by the end of the story, the statue's smiling because the like person the statue is for has gotten vengeance, essentially. Like, they've been laid to rest. And it's really sweet, and I like that kind of like, we're just going to focus laser tight on this one very specific area, you know?
Hmm. It's focusing on fashion, I think, in that one, that the other works show an appreciation of fashion, but that one is like, it feels very contemporary in the time. You know what I mean? Like, we're going to show what people are wearing. In the same way that the Autumn Journey one, the boy going to see his favorite author, .. feels like the perfect, like, I have researched the hell out of this by watching all the movies about this area and this place and this time. And so it feels like 100% set there. Like, it shows that she can do, you know, she could do crazy shoujo stuff, like, or shoujo, like, sci-fi stuff, just like off the top of her head. Or she could do this, like, period piece, or she could do something ultra contemporary and everyone's dressed in, like, whatever the hottest fashions were at the time. Like, I don't know, just draped in shawls all the time, but, like, with beautiful little patterns and things. Or actually, that story in particular felt more of a place in a time than maybe anything else to me. Mm-hmm. Like, when there's that shot where this, you don't know he's a teacher yet, is like washing his face in the sink with the towel around his head and his hair's kind of messed up. And it's just like, that is the most 1980s manga illustration I have literally ever seen. Like, every single 80s manga and anime has this shot in it, and it all looks exactly like this. Like, it almost doesn't even look like her style. It looks like, kind of like morphs into like a little bit of Yu Yu Hakusho, and then a little bit of Takahashi, and then like a little bit of like other 80s contemporary sex comedy, like romantic comedy manga, just for like that bit. And then when they draw him again, when he's a teacher, 100% into Jose, like protagonist, like male love interest style. Like, they don't even look like they're in the same story or the same person.
Well, they don't even act like they're in the same. Like, that was the one thing I didn't like about the story, was just the fact that like his personality shift was just so great that I was just like, I wasn't really buying any of it.
Mm. Yeah, the child who comes home.
I get that. Mm. Oh, we haven't talked about Child Who Comes Home.
Yeah, I loved it pretty much every page, but I don't have much to say about it. It was just like, if I can use competent as like a really good descriptor for a story, it was just like effortlessly competent and really engaging.
I caught the twist right away. So the story kind of was just like, okay, I'm just kind of following this through to the end.
Mm-hmm.
And like, seeing all the hoops they jump through to try and hide it from the reader was a little distracting. Like, she goes, and then I say this every day because I want to remember him, kind of thing. Like, okay, yeah, we get it.
I think it's good that they did Sixth Sense 20 years before Sixth Sense.
Yeah.
In 1980. That was pretty fun.
Yeah.
I actually forgot the twist of that one. And it wasn't until about halfway through that I actually started to be like, oh, right. And if you read it from the beginning, knowing what the, like, if you reread that story when you get to the end, yeah, it's so obvious. And maybe if you're a detective like Chip.
Or a master storyteller. Well,
master storyteller Chip Zdarsky.
There were two things, like the first shot of Ghost Child running past Mother. Mm-hmm. There's a difference in the style there. Like, they never use kind of a black on that character. So as soon as he runs by her, I'm like, oh, wait, is he? And when the brother towards the bottom says, I'm home, I'm like, no one would say I'm home when their little brother just ran ahead of them.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the things that made me figure it out. I'm super smart.
Yeah, for me, it was on the next page. There's that awkward pause where she says, now you, no playing. And the brother kind of looks at her and then looks back to his homework.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we're too smart for this.
Finally, a book that I'm too smart for.
Effortless is a really good descriptor because it is just like really good comics, but it's not.
Yeah, there's some beautiful. Mind-blowing. There's some beautiful stuff in it.
Yeah.
I want to give a little shout out to Rachel for the translation, because I think she puts a lot of care into trying to capture the tone of Moto Hagio's work. There, I don't know. I mean, it's largely invisible to me.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like it was a good translation, but I mean, it's hard to tell, like you're saying.
Yeah.
It's kind of invisible. There was nothing that anyone said that I was like, oh, that was a little bit weird. It all felt like it was of the piece. Like, it felt integral to the work, if that makes sense. Like,
was there anything you read that made you go, oh, that's pretty good? So sometimes we focus on things that clang in translation as a way of judging it. Like, this doesn't fit, this doesn't work. But sometimes it's about like little turns of phrase that are very smooth, mm-hmm. that you don't skip over them, but you still notice them. Like in BL Metamorphosis, I think at one point someone says, my eyes were bigger than my stomach. And I'm like, oh, like, that's it. Like, this is good writing because this is what this type of character would say. Mm-mm-mm. Was there anything like this, like that in this for you three?
Nothing that really struck me as great localization, you know, like, mm-hmm. oh, that was a great choice or I got a sense of like what awkward phrase this would have otherwise been in Japanese.
Yeah.
But, and then they just like, they didn't take the extra step to go beyond the literal translation into a conversational translation, you know, like mm-hmm. tadaima, right? Like, or tadaima means like, when you come home, like, I'm home, and you know, or like, or itadakimasu before you eat, and gochisousama deshita is like after, but you mm-hmm. know, people go, thanks for the eats, you know, like I've seen all kinds of ways people try to localize that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Gambare is maybe the worst example of that.
Guts.
Like, everyone's like, yeah, guts.
Just try your best.
Here's the best way I can explain it. This is an anthology that was edited by Rachel and translated, like, where the stories were chosen by Rachel. And according to Wikipedia, Rachel ran like a poll on like a fan group of Moto Hagios in Japan.
Oh, no kidding.
What are the best Moto Hagio short stories? And then sort of chose from that and from their own favorites, right? Mm. And I didn't pick up on it until David gave his impression of the book. And it's like, yeah, it's about, all the stories are about people. Maybe it was Deb, I apologize if it was you, but it was like, it's all about people who are like, don't quite fit in the real world, and who are like, and who, you know, find a way, even if they're, or are zapped out of existence. But like, but these people that are just like, just don't quite fit into their time and place. And I think that that's an interesting thing, because it's, yeah, I mean, almost all of the manga stories sort of are on that theme, except for maybe the very last one. Mm-hmm. And is that because Rachel chose those stories to exemplify that theme? Or is that a theme that runs through literally all of Moto Hagio's work, and you can't get away from that theme? And
I think it's the latter, honestly.
I haven't read enough to know for sure.
Or all their most successful pieces.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that could be the thing. Like, maybe she did try to tackle other themes and it just didn't work as well.
But
nobody liked her superhero comics.
So in the same way I can't tell about that, I can't tell about the translation.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
Okay. There's no way for me to know without having read both. And if I did read both and I was that fluent and I could compare the two, I probably wouldn't go in on the translator if I didn't like their translation, because yeah, that yeah. would be kind of a shitty thing to do. Yeah. They did a whole book. We wouldn't have got it if they like didn't pitch this book and this and do this work and whatever. So like, yeah, I don't know. It's tough to say. It's tough to say.
I have two that I'll share and then I'll stop talking. But there was when the in Iguana Girl, when the father asked, "Are these maternity blues?" Where I was like, "Oh, that's like totally what like a desperate dad would pull out of his pocket after his wife throws a baby across the room."
it's such a dismissive, like, not postpartum depression, is it? Maternity blues. You got a case of the baby sads?
Oh my God, you've got a localized manga chip. That's good.
Yeah, that's super good. And in the story before that, the angel story, when the guy says, "You want the wings for the child," I was like, oh, like that's really good.
Yeah.
Even though that story wasn't quite, you know, fully in my bag, I thought that was both great writing on Hagio's part and a great localization in terms of both not getting it, in terms of staying out of the way of the original work, but also enhancing it at the same time.
Yeah.
Mm. Like just something about the curtness of it.
Yeah, there are a lot of nice, like, in a lot of the stories, nice little kind of poetic bits that, you know, I have no idea how much was the original, how much was the translation.
But it's good stuff.
Yeah.
You know what? There's one part that stuck out in a negative way, and I think it wasn't the fault of the translator. I think it was the fault. And it was in Angel, it was the Angel story, Angel Mimic, where like you're finding and you finally find out why she's so depressed, and you think it like maybe there's something bigger than her family just being away or whatever. And she has this like declarative statement about having had an abortion and how it's like covering up her head. And you're like, I'm sure that was like a huge revelation in a girl's comic in the 1970s. Like that would have been a big deal to have that story and to have her say that. But it is so clunky the way she like exposits that information in that moment. And I think it would have, as a translator, I think that's actually how it was in the Japanese. Mm. I actually think that's 100% how it was in the Japanese. And as a translator, as an editor, I would want to soften that and make it more conversational and make it more how that conversation might actually have gone at the time or even go today. But I think as a translator, you sort of owe it to the work. It's like, oh, that was dropped in there because that's a bombshell moment, especially in the time when it's written. So it read as clunky to me, but it read as perfectly translated, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like that was something where I was like, I wish that this sequence could have been handled a little bit differently because, you know, it's a sensitive issue and it's presented almost like it's a little shock value-y, but that would have been at the time, right? Like 79
or whatever. Wasn't it a 2008 story?
Mm-hmm. Angel Mimic, according to Wikipedia, which again, we are all taking this with a grain of salt because it's Wikipedia. Angel Mimic, November 1984, sorry.
Interesting. Okay. So the way the book is organized for the listeners who maybe don't have it is the first three stories are from copyright 1997. The next three are 85. Then the next three are 2008. And then it closes on 2007.
Oh, the story is not accurate.
Yeah. That doesn't give you the context of when these stories were actually created and published. It's the copyright date. So I think that's maybe too bad. Like in some of the essay, it mentions, you know, dates of some works, but not specifically as it relates, doesn't give the context for each story. It's more like a context of Moto Hagio's career and, you know, the years that her most significant noteworthy works came out, right? Versus here's when this work came out and it was in this magazine for this audience. But that's why you listen to Mangasplaining.
Right? Yeah. We will copy and paste from the Wikipedia and include that in the show notes.
Give $2 to Wikipedia.
they're begging right now. Please give them some money.
Give us $3.
So yeah.
This was a good chat. I think we've talked about A Drunken Dream for a little while. Does anyone have any closing thoughts? I feel like I've said more than I need to say about it, but I really liked it. I'm glad you all liked it too. Anybody else got anything they want to add?
Iguana Girl has cute outfits.
I'd say I'd give it a 97%. Why couldn't it just be 100%? Need to work harder.
Need to work harder. Could be 100%.
Got to give 110.
Yep.
in order to get 100.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Even though this book was out of print for quite a while, I'm really glad that they did a second printing. I think that's. Mm. I think Fantagraphics deserves some credit for that because, you know, a classic shoujo manga is not always an easy sell or not a sure bet. And they put out a really lovely edition. Even the second edition has the schmancy gold stamping on it.
Oh, yeah. Shout out to Adam Grano, who did the design, who also does JoJo's for me and all the Taiyo Matsumoto stuff for Viz.
Nice.
And also that, you know, that they've since then published two volumes of Otherworld Barbara. They also published the first volume of Poclan, and hopefully the second volume will come out soon.
Hard to promise.
And, you know, also shout out to Denpa because they're publishing Little Leo, which is her, it's kind of like Iguana Girl style because it's about a little cat, a cat who wants to find a job. But it's not like Cheese Sweet Home. It's like a cat that stands on its 2 feet. So they're also republishing They Were 11, right?
So, are they really? Mm-hmm. They're doing, Denpa's going to do They Were 11? Uh-huh. Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So I'm really grateful because Botahogyo, I think, is a really important and interesting creator. She's incredibly smart and her stories are so special. I'm really glad to see that more of it is being available in English. It's not what I would recommend to a new manga reader. It's a little dense. It's a little hard to get into sometimes, but I think it's very rewarding.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, thanks to Fantagraphics for doing this instead of publishing some Sailor Moon crap.
Oh, yeah, leave the easy money on the table for someone else.
Right?
Oh, I actually have one final word on this book.
Bianca. Bianca.
We'll be right back. And we're back from what was hopefully a very satisfying break for all of us. Today, we are going to skip question and answer session yet again. We're sorry about that. But we just keep talking about the books we're talking about, and it just keeps going on and on. Please do keep sending in your questions on, you know, Twitter, direct message, Instagram, email us, whatever you want to do. We are reading these questions as they come in, but we just got to every once in a while produce an episode.
Yeah, I've got a mostly Q&A episode planned in the future, so we'll see how it goes.
Perfect, perfect. But what we are doing this week is choosing our next round of books. Those of you who've been following along at home, you've been noticing we've been picking every 2 weeks, even though we always pick 3 to 4 books at a time. And it's just because of the manga shortage. I'm going to be completely honest with you. The printing shortage, it's harder and harder for people to get copies of books that we recommend in any kind of time period. Like, even though Drunken Dream was reprinted, Chip still couldn't get a copy in time for this week's thing. So I lent him mine.
I'm also very lazy.
After this week, we're gonna do it every 4 episodes or so. So we'll be way ahead. So if you're reading along with us, A, thank you so much. And B, don't worry, we're going to stop giving you books to buy for at least a month.
They make great Christmas gifts.
But not anything we've reviewed. Actually, you know what? On mongsplaining.com, look forward to the books that we actually recommend coming soon. We already checked it out. It's pretty good. Anyway, so this week we're picking new books, and they will be after our next batch of books. We colluded. We colluded this week to maybe pick books on a theme. And then I don't know why we ended up colluding this way, but we did. And it was pick some classic manga. And it's what a perfect time to talk about that, since we reviewed a classic manga this week in A Drunken Dream by Motohagio. And so we're going to pick some classics. I feel like a lot of the reprint projects don't get all the love in the world that they deserve because people clamor for them, and then you're lucky to sell 2,000 copies. So anything we can do to help turn the tide, anything we can help bring this rich history of manga back into print in North America and make it successful, I'm on board with. But I'm not going to go first. I am going to pick David because I just listened to the episode where David made me go first 3 times.
Chris, could you go first?
No, I cannot. I cannot go first. Chip, do you want to go?
Yeah.
I can go first. It's okay. I will forgive Chris and get him back on the next episode that I host, which I think is next week. So I don't know why you're throwing shots today.
David, just knock this one out of the park.
Just do it. Do it.
This one is by a manga creator named Go Nagai. He is... very classic. He's known for doing a lot of like giant robot stuff, lots of like superhero stuff, that kind of thing. And this one is called Devilman. and it is 100% what it sounds like. It's the story of a high school student named Akira Fudo, who absorbs the powers of a demon and becomes Devil Man, and basically goes out and hunts demons using the power of demons with his friend Ryo, who does drugs and has a machine gun for the most part. It's a
wow. Wow.
Yeah, it's a hot mess. There's a fantastic anime adaptation called Devilman Crybaby, but what we're going to be focusing on is the Devilman hardcover that Seven Seas put out, Devilman the Classic Collection, Volume 1. All right. And it's a bit longer than most manga that we've read so far. I think it's about 600 pages, but it's one volume.
Okay, you're losing me a bit, but all right, all right.
And it's like, it, you'll know if you like it or not within 8 pages. Like, it's that crazy. So I think we'll have some fun.
All right. Okay, good.
Will this be the first manga that Chip doesn't finish because after 8 pages, he's like, forget this? Let's find out.
Yeah. Chris, how about you?
Excellent, concise pitch, David. Chris?
As host, I would like to pick Deb now. Deb.
All right.
What manga would you like to recommend?
I don't know how that became the rule, but anyways.
I believe it is.
Well, as much as I would have loved to pick another classic shoujo manga to offset Devilman, unfortunately, that's not so easy because there isn't that much of it out there. Mm. So I'm going to go with something that maybe has some personal relevance for all of us. That is Kamen Rider by Shotaro Ishinomori. In our trip to Japan, we went to the Shotaro Ishinomori Mangatan in Ishinomaki, where there was a huge exhibit that was, I'd say, 50% Kamen Rider. And I thought to myself, oh, poor Chip, do you get this? Does this make sense to you that this one character or this one franchise, which is basically the equivalent of like all of the Batman family, like the most popular like superhero franchise in Japan, that it's basically about a guy who has superpowers. He rides a motorcycle. He has a mask, which is common means mask, but he looks like a grasshopper. He has superpowers. He has amazing motorcycle. He's beating a terrorist organization that's going to destroy the world. Even though actually he is part, his origin is because he was genetically mutated by that secret organization. It's basically like Shotaro Ishinomori is like the Jack Kirby of Japan. Wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. Lots of action. And it's coming out, the hardcover version is coming out from Seven Seas in mid-December. So we will get, by the time we talk about it, it will be barely a month old in print.
Nice.
Maybe the nice folks at Seven Seas will even provide us with a review copy. Chip can have your book on his shelf.
But I just wanted to, throw that out to you because I thought, you know, when we talk about superhero comics in Japan, right, we talk like, oh, My Hero Academia, we talk about One Punch Man. And I want to say that I think Shotaro Ishinomori is just an amazing creator. And I think you would appreciate that on both an artistic level and on what superheroes look like in Japan.
Hmm. I will say visiting that museum with you guys made me feel like I was losing my mind.
Oh, really? How's that?
It's so weird to go through a place dedicated to something that, you know, frankly, is quite juvenile that I don't know anything about. Like, you go around the corner and it's these characters. I have no idea what's going on, the context, but people have like painstakingly and lovingly created 3D versions of them for everyone to enjoy. I'm like, what? Who is this? What is that monkey character? Yeah. Who is this old man? I don't know. It's very, very weird. It's a very surreal thing to go through an entire, basically, yeah, children. It's that weird thing. It's like a children's museum.
It kind of
it's a museum for a children's character, but it's sort of like how if there was a Superman museum,
yeah,
like a lot of it would be for kids, but not necessarily all for kids. It's kind of like that.
I know, and it's funny. Like, it just made me really realize, like, how a lot of the things I love in North America are for children. But you don't quite get it until you see something in another country that is like also that way. Cause I'm just like, what? Why are we going through this place that's for kids? And I'm like, oh, okay. I get it. Cause I would do exactly the same thing for Superman or whatever.
Yeah. Will we get sued if I use the Kamen Rider theme song on that episode?
Nah. I don't think
people are copyright claiming podcasts yet. maybe the YouTube version.
I think it's a good use of all the amazing podcast money we're making off this to fight it legally.
Nice. Done and done.
I think that would be funny because, oh, you know what we could do? We could say that we don't accept legal correspondence by email, and then they need to send us a letter, and then you'd have
like letterhead
and with a legal thread on it, and you could put that on your wall. That'd be really worth it, actually.
Yeah.
Like, I love that.
You are thinking five steps ahead. Amazing.
Finally, I can call on Chris.
Chris,
put your pick.
And Chris, just so you know, I'm doing a countdown. You've got 1 minute starting now.
So for my pick, I am stretching the bounds of classic manga. And if Deb, David, if you want to shut this down and be like, no, you need an older one, I'm totally okay with that. But I realized I can't think of any other way we'd ever read Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind by Hayao Miyazaki, because I would never go and pick it because it's such a weird thing to like. It's such an important work, but it's such a weird thing. But 1982, so I feel like that's kind of classic. How do you guys feel about that in the classic sense?
Yeah, let's do it.
It's fine with me. I just worried that can Chip get it?
Yeah, Chip's gonna be pissed.
Yeah, it's in print. I checked.
Okay.
So, and if not, I'll lend him a copy. Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind is by Hayao Miyazaki, who's now known as like the cranky old man of animation, who's like a genius who just keeps talking shit about everyone except for Hideki Anno. And Nausicaa was the manga that he made that ran in an anime magazine, like an anime fan magazine.
1-0. Okay, so what I'm going to say now is, I'm going to let you continue, but that was 1 minute without telling us anything about the book.
Nausicaa is an environmental tale.
Oh,
if you've seen Nausicaa, or if you've seen Princess Mononoke, Princess Mononoke is almost like a redo of Nausicaa with like the environmental themes of man versus nature, you know, the reaping what we have sown as a society, about the end times of humanity, about how pollution's taking over the earth, and this one girl might hold the key to saving the last of us. It's a really good environmental fable, and it doesn't look anything like any manga we've read, and maybe doesn't look anything like any manga we're going to read.
Okay.
Miyazaki was really heavily influenced by European comics, by Mobius especially. So Nausicaa is a 7-volume series. It's collected as a standalone hardcover slipcase situation with all 7 volumes in it. You know what? I'm going to recommend this one like the last time we made a recommendation. Just start reading it. Read at least volume 1. And if you want to see what happens next, keep reading. And if you don't, don't. But I think that there's a lot to talk about in Nausicaa. And I think it's a really interesting book that we don't think of as classic manga, but absolutely is, and maybe influenced, you know, through Miyazaki's ongoing work in animation. I think that's influenced more comics than a hell of a lot of manga maybe ever gets credit for.
All right. You saved it.
Well, I just didn't know if they're going to let me have 1982 as classic manga. You guys picked stuff from like 72. So
yeah.
I didn't want to.
You're a cheater, but that's all right.
I'm a cheater.
All right. So here, the drum roll. This is what I'll say. First of all, I'm going with Devil Man because he's got a buddy that does drugs and has a machine gun. David understands my needs, my desires in a way
we
that
really are
frankly,
the same person.
Yeah, Dev and Chris, you just don't.
Sorry.
I'm going to do Nausicaa next because, frankly, I haven't actually seen any of the movies that you're referencing either. Not a fan of animation. So, but I've heard people talk about Nausicaa a lot, and I think that'd be a good one to tackle. Kamen Rider is dead last because it sounds kind of dumb.
It also gives us some leeway because I'm not sure when we can get the books.
Yeah. There's also that. Yeah. Mid-December. So yeah, those are my decrees and so shall it be.
Fair and just as always, sir.
Thank you.
So that means that after this episode, this is the, where are we on this list? This is the Drunken Dream episode. We have next week is Raw Hero, followed by the short story Look Back, then Vinland Saga Volume 1, Golden Kamuy Volume 1, Wotokoi Volume 1, and then another classic manga, Gundam the Origin Volume 1, and then Devilman, Nausicaa, and Kamen Rider.
Can I just point out that the smile on David's face when you said Raw Hero...
It's going to be such a mess.
Really, really. It makes me really look forward to reading it.
Oh, man. I'm I haven't read it yet. I just found out it's out of print too. We're having a tough time recommending books that are actually in print, but it's in between printings at Yen. Hopefully they decide to bring it back at some point. But we'll all be reading that one digitally, unless we already happen to own the physical copies. Maybe Mark will hook us up. Anyway, this has been an episode. It's been a fun time. I really enjoyed it. Thank you to my panelists, my co-panelists here. Thanks to everyone listening at home. We will see you again next week for Raw Hero.
Bianca.
This has been Mangasplaining, episode 37, A Drunken Dream and Other Stories by Moto Hagio. Thanks for listening. For our next episode, we'll be discussing the manga Raw Hero by Akira Hiramoto. Want to pick up a copy? Consider supporting your local comic book and manga specialty shop. You can find one near you at comicshoplocator.com or check your local library for print and digital lending options. You can also follow along with our complete reading list at mangasplaining.com. Thanks as always to DADS for their musical accompaniment this episode.